Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2009 and Ruination, the early years.
How does a man actually survive, you know, a completely soul-crushing 10-hour corporate shift? I mean, if you're looking at June 2009 in the big fatty universe, you don't do it through, like, meditation or quiet quitting.
Definitely not.
No. You do it by broadcasting the literal poop of the century, defacing the pristine magic of Disney World, and eating six-month expired Brazilian bacon.
Which just sounds like a total breakdown.
Okay.
But when you really dig into the source material, it's actually this highly sophisticated, deeply weird survival strategy.
I am King.
And I am Gail.
Welcome to Ruination, the early years. And let's just make it clear right up front, this is a deep dive into the source material covering June 2009.
Right.
We are opening a very specific time capsule today. We're examining what happens when the grueling new reality of a do job smacks headfirst into a month of intense social events, high-tech transitions, and just chaotic community live streams.
Yeah, and I want you, the listener, to think about a time when your own professional obligations felt like, you know, a straitjacket.
Mm.
And your personal life was the only place you could actually breathe.
Oh, totally.
Because that exact tension, that friction between the sterile office and the messy biological reality of being a human is the engine driving everything we're about to explore today.
It really is. And to understand June 2009, you really have to understand the sheer weight of the schedule change at the coal mine. Because June 1st is supposed to be this huge milestone, right?
Yeah, it's the start of his 20th year in his current position.
Exactly. Even though he's been at the company since 1980. But instead of a gold watch or a parade, what does he get? A mandatory 4-day, 10-hour work schedule.
And for a creature of habit, I mean, this isn't just an inconvenience. It's a localized earthquake.
It really is.
His alarm now goes off at 5:40 a.m.
Ugh. Brutal.
Right. The sacred morning routine, the slow coffee, the newspaper, it's entirely shredded. He's just dragging.
Mm.
He notes that he's in a foul mood the absolute second his feet hit the floor.
10 hours a day in that environment. But, you know, the source material gives us this perfectly timed, almost like two-on-the-nose event that captures the whole atmosphere.
Oh, the gas leak.
Yes. A construction crew across the street hits a gas main, and the entire coal mine has to be evacuated to the street.
I love how he actually jokes that it's the first time in the history of the company that there was more gas outside the building than inside.
Right. Which is funny, but also it's deeply telling. Because he's suffocating. The environment is literally and figuratively toxic.
Totally.
And so how does the month kick off in response to that? With his internet friend, Miss West, arriving in the Chucktown for what they officially dub a barbecue eating tour of the South.
Oh, boy. And they really go for it. They hit Jim and Nick's. They tour the local pubs. And the biological consequences are severe.
To put it mildly.
Yeah. When Miss West flies back to San Diego, she delivers what becomes immortalized on the show as the poop of the century report.
The poop of the century.
She is in such intense gastrointestinal distress from all that southern barbecue that she actively struggles to use the tiny airplane lavatory.
And he broadcasts this. He meticulously details his friend's mid-air intestinal crisis. And I'm just trying to wrap my head around why he focuses so much on this specific story.
Right. Like, why share it?
Exactly. You could just say, we ate too much, she felt sick. But he leans so hard into the graphic reality of it.
Well, it's definitely juvenile, but it's also, you know, it's a hallmark of their dynamic. They don't hide the ugly stuff.
Yeah, but I wonder if it's more than just a juvenile joke. Like, think about it like a tax.
A tax.
Yeah. When you spend 10 hours a day in a sterile, fluorescent-lit, highly regulated corporate environment, it acts as a tax on your basic humanity.
Okay, I'm with you.
You have to be clean, polite, completely compartmentalized. So maybe leaning hard into the poop of the century is this subconscious way to reclaim his humanity.
Mm.
Like, he's forcefully reminding himself and his audience that beneath that corporate drone exterior, we are all just gross biological creatures who eat too much pork and destroy airplane bathrooms.
I see exactly where you're going with that.
Yeah.
It's an overcorrection. The system demands sanitization, so he rebels by spotlighting the grotesque.
Exactly.
And honestly, if we follow that logic, it explains exactly why his trip to Orlando for the annual gay days at Disney unfolds the way it does.
Oh my gosh, yes. The Orlando trip is just an absolute masterpiece of inappropriate behavior. He goes down to the Pop Century Resort, sharing a room with Larry Cly, and the tone is set immediately by the hotel staff.
Right, because they receive the Family of the Day certificate.
They do.
Which comes with a complimentary turndown service.
A nice manicured Disney touch, right?
Yeah.
And how does he receive it? Two large women from housekeeping knock on the door, and he opens it half-dressed in mesh shorts, his entire face just slathered in shaving cream, holding a razor.
It's so unhinged.
He just stands there, offering to let them do the turndown service while he continues shaving in his underwear.
The visual of that is staggering. I mean, you have Disney, the most meticulously controlled environment on the planet, attempting to deliver a magical hospitality moment, and they are greeted by a guy in his underwear leaking shaving cream onto the carpet.
And it doesn't stop with the hotel staff. Miss West is rooming with them at one point during this trip, and the biological warfare just continues.
Oh, the complaints.
She complains endlessly about the snoring, the fact that he laughs out loud in his sleep, and of course, the constant ham gas.
It's bad enough that Miss West actually engineers a defense system.
A defense system?
Yes. She sets up a fan specifically angled to blow the stench back across the room into his space.
But the defining moment of the trip, the thing that ends up immortalized online, is the photo on the Gay Days blog, the infamous Guess the Crotch picture.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. Fellow podcasters Ryan and Jason are in the shot, forcing their heads down toward him while his anatomy is visibly hanging out of his shorts.
Well, which is wildly inappropriate for a public Disney blog. But what fascinates me is the tension in his own behavior.
Who so?
Because he's acting like a literal biohazard in the hotel room, right? And posing for scandalous photos. But then he goes to the parks, rides the Toy Story attraction with Mr. Potato Head, and proudly wears an official Disney I'm Celebrating button.
Wait, I feel like those two things completely contradict each other. I mean, if he hates the sanitized corporate vibe, why is he wearing the badge and riding the rides?
Well, because he genuinely loves the spectacle. He doesn't hate Disney. He just refuses to experience it on their terms.
Okay, I think I see it. It's like he's treating the Disney parks the way a graffiti artist treats a pristine, newly painted wall.
Ooh, I like that.
The artist doesn't hate the wall, right? They need the wall to make the art work. The fact that Disney is so relentlessly engineered to be perfect makes his flatulence, his mesh shorts, and his inappropriate photos feel like a victory.
Right.
He is defacing the corporate magic to prove he still exists outside the 5:40 a.m. alarm clock.
That's a really great distinction. The pristine wall makes the graffiti pop. But, you know, while he's successfully rebelling against the physical environment in Orlando, the digital environment back home is quietly preparing to sabotage him.
Oh, right.
Because June 2009 is a massive transitional moment for technology.
A huge moment.
Yeah.
Apple launches the new iPhone 3GS. And of course, true to form, he refuses to acknowledge the actual name of the product.
Naturally. He dubs it the inappropriate phone, or sometimes the instant phone.
Right.
But regardless of what he calls it, he's still at the store at 7 a.m. to buy it.
But he doesn't pay retail. This is one of his great frugal triumphs. He scores this brand new piece of cutting-edge technology for exactly $58 out of pocket.
Which is insane.
How? By hoarding Apple Snack gift cards that were sent to him by a listener, Brian from Boston.
It's a brilliant leveraging of the community's generosity. What feature of this pocket computer is he most thrilled about?
The voice styling and the digital compass. Because, as he openly admits, he gets lost all the time.
It's a very grounding, pragmatic use of new tech. But that honeymoon phase is pretty short-lived because the infrastructure running his actual show just collapses.
Completely.
A GoDaddy server migration goes sideways, and his episodes are trapped in a blackout for 24 hours.
And this isn't just a back-end problem. It causes real friction in the physical world for his audience.
Yeah, he really does.
He points out a listener named Archer whose entire morning routine was ruined because he couldn't listen to the show while eating his Cheerios. The technology failure severed the daily habit.
Which sets the stage perfectly for the centerpiece of the month. Because the community isn't just relying on daily downloads. They are rallying around a massive, live, coordinated event.
The Pride 48 streaming weekend.
Exactly.
This is a huge deal. It's prime time. He is handed the Friday 9:00 p.m. kickoff slot right after the opening ceremonies. I mean, the entire network is tuned in.
And the execution is, well, it's a disaster.
It's a total train wreck.
He gets heavily intoxicated on Tanqueray and tonics.
He is audibly wrecked. He fumbles the broadcasting software so severely that he streams exactly 20 minutes of dead, unbroken silence to the entire Pride 48 network.
Oh, my God.
20 minutes of nothing on a live primetime showcase.
It's a catastrophic technical failure. By any conventional broadcasting metric, this should be a humiliation. You were given the spotlight, and you drop the ball in front of everyone. But the community's reaction is entirely the opposite.
It is.
The chat room just explodes with joy. They celebrate the disaster, joking that he personally killed Pride 48.
I don't get that. I really don't. You tune in for a show, the guy is too drunk to hit the on button, and you cheer. Like, why aren't the organizers furious? Why isn't the chat room happy?
Because the perfection of the broadcast isn't what they value. They value the unpredictable nature of the host.
Have you ever been to a basement punk show?
I have, yeah.
Okay, if you go to a raw punk show and the guitarist blows out an amp and the sound just dies, the crowd doesn't demand a refund.
No, they don't.
They cheer louder. Because you aren't there for perfect audio fidelity. You are there for the danger. You want the chaos.
Right.
When he broadcasts 20 minutes of silence because of the Tanqueray, it validates that this isn't a slick, overproduced corporate operation. It's a high-wire act without a net. The failure proves it's real.
The failure is the authenticity. I completely agree with that. And when the digital servers fail and the technology proves unreliable, how does this community maintain that authentic connection?
They fall back on physical anchors.
Exactly. And the weirdest, most enduring physical anchor they have is the mail they send each other.
Oh, the mail. We have to talk about the physical items showing up at his door because it crosses the line from generous to genuinely dangerous.
Seriously.
A listener named Frank from Atlanta brings over a bag of bacon Zitos. These are bacon-flavored snacks acquired on our trip to Brazil.
And he inspects the bag live on the air. He reads the expiration date out loud. It says December 22, 2008.
Right. And it is currently June of 2009. These foreign meat snacks are 6 months expired. And what does he do? He rips the bag open and crunches into them live on the microphone. He literally gambles his digestive system for the sake of the broadcast.
It is a remarkable display of trust.
Huh.
Or perhaps just culinary recklessness.
I would the latter.
Yeah, but it highlights the tangible tether between the host and the audience.
Yeah.
I mean, he receives mail from a Canadian listener named Turniphead. He gets a deeply heartfelt letter from Michelle, a straight listener whose husband also tunes in.
Oh, that's sweet.
It is. These digital usernames manifest as physical letters and occasionally expired Brazilian snacks on his kitchen counter.
But it's not just what they mail him, it's what they cook.
Oh, the food.
The culinary habits of this community are staggering. Arthur from New Zealand submits a recipe that sounds like a cry for help.
I know exactly what you're going to say.
You take two chocolate fudge Pop-Tarts, toast them, and then sandwich three strips of bacon between them.
And that isn't even an anomaly. Another recipe involves taking a hamburger patty, rolling it completely flat, stuffing it with bacon and cheese, rolling it up into the shape of a hot dog.
A hot dog.
Wrapping the entire outside in more bacon and grilling it.
It is architectural gluttony. And contrast that madness with his own domestic habits. He talks about cooking a massive batch of corned beef and cabbage, slowly boiling it overnight in a crock pot.
Which sounds so traditional compared to the Pop-Tarts.
Right. And while the community is dreaming up Pop-Tart bacon sandwiches, he is at the Publix grocery store performing surgical coupon strikes. He proudly announces he bought a $7.50 submarine sandwich, but managed to save $7.10 at the register.
That's a 94% discount.
Yeah.
He is paying 40 cents for a full sub.
Uh-huh.
The duality is fascinating. He encourages this extreme hypercaloric excess from his audience while meticulously balancing his grocery receipts down to the dime.
But I'm stuck on the food they submit. Like, why the Pop-Tart sandwich? Why the bacon-wrapped burger dog? Do you think it's just them being gluttonous, or is there a function to it?
I mean, it certainly gets them airtime on the show.
True, but I think it's deeper. It reminds me of teenagers sitting at a high school lunch table, daring each other to mix ketchup and milk and drink it.
Oh, ew.
Right. It's a shared ritual of revulsion. When you have a community scattered from New Zealand to Canada, you can't share a beer at a local bar. But you can dare each other to eat something horrific. It takes an invisible, scattered network and makes it feel like a physical neighborhood hanging out in a basement.
A shared ritual of revulsion. That makes a lot of sense. It grounds them in a shared physical experience, no matter how gross.
Exactly.
But while they're busy bonding over expired bacon Zitos and 40-cent Publix subs in the present, his mailbox delivers something that forces a much darker conversation about the future.
Ah, the existential math of aging. We talked about how the 10-hour days at the coal mine are slowly draining him. Then, right in the middle of all this, he receives his annual Social Security statement.
And he doesn't just quietly file it away.
Oh, no.
No, he brings it to the microphone and walks the audience through his meticulous calculations.
Mm-hmm.
He breaks down the tiers. Like, if he retires early at age 62, he gets $3,385 a month.
Yeah.
If he holds out for full retirement at 66 and 4 months, it jumps to $1,901. And he makes it to age 70, it maximizes at $2,482.
He starts charting out the break-even points on air. He calculates that to make waiting for the larger payouts worth it, he would have to live to age 77 or 80. And doing this math triggers a deep, visceral panic.
It really does.
Because he takes an online longevity quiz to see if he'll make it to those break-even years, and the quiz predicts he is going to live to be 96.
His reaction to that number is sheer terror.
He starts yelling. He says he does not want to live to be the sea hag's age referencing his podcaster rival, Auntie Vera.
Right.
The sheer idea of existing for nearly a century horrifies him.
It drives him to a very pragmatic, cynical conclusion. After looking at all the math, he openly declares he is going to take the money as early as possible at age 62. He has zero faith that the Social Security system will even exist long term to pay out the higher tiers.
Okay, hold on. Can we just acknowledge the massive, jarring paradox of this man?
The paradox of taking the money early.
The paradox of his entire worldview. Think about it. He is like a race car driver who refuses to wear a seatbelt during a race, but then goes home and obsessively balances his checkbook to the penny.
That's a hilarious image.
But it's true. How does a person who willingly eats six-month expired Brazilian meat on a dare and broadcasts his flatulence to strangers also sit down at a desk to chart a 15-year break-even trajectory for his federal retirement benefits?
Because that's the reality of the human condition.
Yeah.
We are a mess. We are chaotic creatures trying desperately to manage our own survival. He rebels against the corporate structure, but he still has to pay rent when he's 70.
That's fair. And despite his cynicism about the government and his fear of aging, the source material reveals the genuine, lasting impact he's having right now.
It does.
There's a moment where fellow podcaster John Michael from Chicago leaves a message. He doesn't make a gross joke or talk about bacon. He just earnestly says that Big Fatty is just an awesome person.
Yeah. He points out that beneath the bravado, beneath the shaving cream at Disney in the dead air on Pride 48, there is an exceptionally sweet and kind-hearted person building a real community.
It proves that you don't need a polished, sanitized persona to leave a legacy. Sometimes the unvarnished truth does a much better job.
It really does. So as we wrap up this deep dive into the source material for June 2009, we want to leave you with a final thought to mull over.
Yeah.
We spent a lot of time talking about how much he hated that rigid 10-hour work schedule at the coal mine. But consider the alternative.
What if those rigid constraints are actually the secret catalyst for his creative freedom?
Right.
I mean, if he had all the free time in the world, if he wasn't exhausted and angry from 5:40 a.m. wake-ups, would he still have the raw energy to turn a public sub-discount or a 20-minute silent live stream into legendary community lore?
It's a compelling question. Maybe we only truly discover our most authentic, unfiltered selves when we are forced to push back against a system that demands we be quiet and conform.
Without the pressure cooker, the meal just never cooks. I am King.
And I am Gail.
We invite you to come back next Saturday for another month of Ruination, the early years.
And definitely don't forget to tune in each Sunday for Ruination Repeat, which recaps last week's current BFO episodes.
Thanks for joining us. Here's your final reminder to tune in next weekend for the newest episode of Ruination, the early years. See you then.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination, the early years. Join us again next weekend. We'll see you then.